time for Yakety Science. Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Yakety Science, the Tulsa Science Show. We are the program that shines a bright but humorous light into all of the darkest corners of the caldera, the cirque, and the glacial crevasse. We are the show that finds the getaway in your glaciology, the holiday in your hydrology, the vacay in your volcanology, the siesta in your speleology. I am Brian Cross, Associate Professor of Biology at Tulsa Community College, and your humble host. First up, as always, the Loki to my Odin, Dr. Matt Smith, Associate Professor of Chemistry at Tulsa Community College. Say hello to the nice people, Matt.
Hello, nice people.
What's going on?
So why Loki? Why did you choose to paint me as Loki? Am I a shapeshifter? Am I a...
I don't know. Would you prefer to be Thor?
I guess why did you paint yourself as Odin then?
You don't seem Thor. Well, Odin, that's obvious. I mean,
is it? Is it obvious? I'm interested to know why you it's obvious.
The god of wisdom and and writing and yeah, you know, so all of those things. Scholarship, and learning. He gave his right eye or his left eye, one of his eyes. He gave for wisdom, right?
He has his ravens.
And he
What are his ravens' names?
Something rear, Thrir and Thorir.
You're thinking Fenrir. That's his wolf.
No. Fenrir is the wolf that's like the son of Loki.
Yeah. Hugin and Mugin.
Hugin and Mugin.
Hugin and Mugin.
Hugin and Mugin.
I'm sorry that right. Odin, you don't know the name of your own
Odin,
ravens.
Yeah. So, Odin is one of the believed to be one of the models for Tolkien's invention of Gandalf, because Odin would go about kind of in disguise, wandering about the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
A stranger with a cap and long gray beard and leaning on his staff. And he also stole the magical mead from which poetry and literature comes. There's a great story where he goes in, I think it's the dwarves or something, right? So there's that have this kind of this mead that is that you drink from it, and then you can repeat the Icelandic sagas. And
so it's the mead that has, like, you know,
the mead that has the power,
mushrooms in it, I guess.
It has the power of the, you know, the word, right? It's the power of literature, the power of the poem in it, right? And so he steals it, but he steals it by drinking it down. He turns himself into, I think it's a bird of some kind, and then he drinks it all up, and then he flies away, and he's being chased. He's got to make his way all the way back to the home of the gods, carrying all of this within his belly, and he just barely makes it. But along the way, he, like, poops out some of the mead, because he can't contain it all. He poops it out, and it gets kind of scattered over the earth, and that's why human beings have the gift of poetry.
So drink the mead, learn to read.
That's right. Drink the mead, learn to read. I don't know if it's exactly reading, because a lot of it's oral tradition, right? But it's it's the power of verse. It's the power of poetry, right?
The gift of gab.
Yes. All right. That's enough poorly rendered Norse mythology, I think.
I think so too. Let's move on to something we actually know something about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We might want to get the details on it.
No, I think it's more fun when we don't know.
It's more fun.
And we just kind of try to remember.
Okay. All right.
I mean, Loki, played by, you know, Tom Hiddleston. He's hot. I'm hot. I see the resemblance.
Yeah.
I get it. You, Odin, played by, what's his ass?
Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, I see the resemblance.
Yeah.
You both kind of look like... I'm
feeling older and older and looking more and more like Odin with every passing year. I still thankfully have both of my eyes, but well, I just hope that you don't betray me the way that Loki betrays.
You won't see it coming.
Odin and every other human being on the planet. And you set loose Fenrir upon us. And
Fenrir is my dog. He actually goes by Mushu.
But his name is Fenrir.
Yeah.
His real name is Fenrir.
He's
in disguise.
He's incognito. He's in dognito.
It's funny. He seemed more interested when I met him in getting pets than in swallowing the sun or destroying the world.
Everyone goes through phases.
Yeah.
And this is, he's in his, not quite his brat phase, mm-hmm. but he's not even his world-ending phase
his
either.
This is brat summer.
Yeah.
He's not yet in the world-ending phase. Okay. All right. Well, enough nonsense for now. Are you ready to be puzzled?
I'm ready to be puzzled.
Perpetual state of puzzlement, right?
Curiosity. You know, you have to be curious about the world around you. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you have to be puzzled by it.
I wonder how this doorknob works. Which end of this straw do I drink from? Is it this end or is it that end? Is it this end or is it that end?
Oh, how many holes does a straw have?
It's one.
You think it's just one?
Yeah.
And people say two straws, but I agree. It's only one.
It's a continuous hole.
It's one continuous hole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a tunnel. I guess it has two openings.
I think the topologists or topologists or uh-huh. whatever, the people who study the topos, uh-huh. the surfaces and stuff like that, they call it a...
Topographers.
They called it a torus.
This is like that Mobius.
Basically, a straw is a literally tall donut. It's a torus.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's got one. Yeah.
It's got one hole.
I can see that.
Donut, yeah. One hole. Straw, one hole.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. Up first, we have the puzzler. In this segment, I will challenge you to identify a science-related sound. It could be the sounds made by an animal, physical phenomenon, or it could be something that is associated with science in some other way. Here is your new sound science puzzler. Okay, that is the sound, and that's obviously the Daleks approaching.
Right. This is the Doctor Who special, isn't it?
Right. Yes.
I will give you all a hint. This is a sound that Ailish and I heard in Iceland when we were on vacation there. Uh-huh. So we encountered this sound and wondered what it was, and we were delighted when we learned the truth.
For those who don't know what the Icelandic language sounds like, this is... a greeting.
This is the way. Right. This is how they say hello.
The very introverted Icelandians, this is how they communicate with each other, right? So we'll have the answer for you at the end of the show. And of course, as always, my admonition, right? You must listen to the rest of the show in order to deserve the answer. You won't deserve the answer, and you'll know it deep in your hearts that you don't deserve it unless you listen to Matt drone on and on about Iceland for several hours.
That's true, actually.
That's true.
You're right this time. Yes. Yeah.
All right.
I like how it's you might know the answer, but you won't have deserved it. And therefore, you'll know something you know also that you don't deserve.
And you feel...
The shame will follow you.
And you feel unworthy to share the knowledge with anyone else. All right. Well, up next, we have a mixture of headlines and I guess we'd call it Uncle Traveling Matt's Icelandic Adventure.
That sounds wonderful. Yeah. I mean, I told you last time that if you wanted to have your vacations, we could do that. But you decided not to regale us with too many tales of your adventures and misadventures. So
yeah,
I have no such compunctions. We're going to talk about cool stuff.
It's always been clear that you were the narcissistic one in our little team here. Up next, we have the latest Icelandic headlines. That is, those headlines that relate to information that Matt learned while he was toddling about in the North Atlantic. What do you know, Matt? What can you tell us?
Well, Brian, what comes to mind first when you think about Iceland?
Easy. Snorri Sturluson. Next question.
Why are you always on about Snorri Sturluson?
He's only the single most famous Icelandian of all time.
So he's the only one you know.
Poet, historian, knight. He was twice elected law speaker of the Althing. Most importantly, he was the author of the Prose Edda and the Heimskringla. We wouldn't know half of what we do about Odin and Thor and Loki if it wasn't for Snorri. I mean, can you name another famous Icelandite?
No, I cannot. Not really, no. But other than Snorri, honestly, the name Snorri always makes me think he's like one of the seven dwarfs.
It does sound a little bit like that. But when you see like wood gravings and, you know, etchings of what he looked like. He didn't look like.
He did not look like a dwarf.
He did not look like Dopey or Doc.
Oh, okay. Well, if you say so. All right. Yeah. All right. So what else comes to mind then?
Obviously, setting that aside, the second most famous thing about Iceland is the 1986 summit meeting between Reagan and Gorbachev, obviously.
That's the Cold War. That's 40 years ago. No one's thinking about that.
Actually, I think there's a movie coming out soon. The Brink of War. Yeah, it's got Jeff Daniels in it and J.K. Simmons.
Mm,
Farmers
from
Insurance Spider-Man. Commercials. Yeah. Yeah. Jared Harris. In theaters everywhere, August 14th.
I hate you so much. God, you're so... Okay, look, I was trying to get to volcanoes, the thing people think of most when they think about Iceland.
Do they have volcanoes?
Should be volcanoes.
Do they have volcanoes in Iceland?
Do they have volcanoes in Iceland? Oh my gosh. Iceland has there's about 1,200 Holocene volcanoes. Holocene means that they've been active in the last 12,000 years.
Yep.
But Iceland has 35 of them. So that's a lot for one country. The region is known as the Iceland Neovolcanic Rift Volcanic Province. They put the name volcano in there twice and thought we wouldn't notice. And it's experienced 8 different eruptions that had a VEI scores of 5 to 6. That's Volcanic Explosivity Index.
Yes.
Which I think is a great term. Any sort of rating that has the word explosivity.
And the ones that are world-changing are 8 on that scale.
Right, yes.
And so this is because... You're sitting on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, is that right? And the plates are coming apart, and that's creating a weak spot, and magma is pushing up.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because you also mentioned the All Thing.
Mm-hmm.
The All Thing that Snorri wrote about.
The All Thing is the Parliament, I think.
Yes, which for a time was thought to be located at the separation where the American tectonic plate and the European tectonic plate meet, and they're actually pulling apart. So you can walk down this ridge where it's the cliffs on one side are part of the American system, and what's on the other side are parts of the European system.
Uh-huh.
And it's and that's they there's an area on there that they think is where the All Thing was
met
for a few years.
So could you say the word tectonic again?
Oh no. Is it not tectonic? What do I say?
No. You pronounced it in the way you pronounced the word atom. You had it was the, one of the weird T's in there.
Tectonic.
Tectonic. Anyway, if we go back and listen to the tape, you said it more normally there. But I just had a flash. It was we've discovered another word that
it's just T's apparently. It's T's.
To which you bring the odd. Bizarre chemistry pronunciation.
Well, I sound like every other Oklahoman.
Right.
I'm a native Oklahoman. I've always lived here. I sound just like all other Oklahomans you've met.
When people are envisioning you out there, it's like a piece of wheat in your mouth, a stalk
of wheat,
and overalls, and a cowboy hat. And I have to tell everyone out there that this is exactly right.
That's right.
Exactly what I'm looking at right now.
Yeah, and apparently a bow tie, but... It just really ties the whole outfit together.
All right.
Is what it does.
What else do you know? We've got lots of volcanoes there.
Lots of volcanoes.
Lots of activity. People have probably seen on the news fire at night, flows of lava in recent years.
Right? Oh, yeah. But the thing we came across mostly, because, it's not... any live, volcanic eruptions while we were there. Thank goodness, because getting home would be really hard.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it was lava fields. All of the remnants of volcanic eruptions. After leaving Reykjavik, we found our first lava field in the Snæfellsnes Peninsula on Snæfellsnes.
Snæfellsnes. Yeah, are you confident in that pronunciation?
No. not a bit, but I feel pretty good about that
one. Okay, how about the national park here that follows?
It is Snæfellsjökull.
Snæfellsjökull. Jökull.
Yes, okay. National park.
And you're confident about that too?
I am.
Okay.
I feel pretty good about those two.
Okay.
Usually whenever we go somewhere, we have to Google the pronunciation.
And you get that AI-generated...
No,
YouTube
no, we
video.
Gotta skip those people. Go until you find an actual person speaking it, and we're like, yeah, okay, this person looks like they're afraid of the camera enough to be an Icelander. Yeah, absolutely. The lava fields didn't look like what I thought a lava field was supposed to. I think I was always imagining Pahoehoe lava.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it's kind of this sort of smoothish black surfaces. Mm-hmm. Think, you know, like,
it's like the
slopes of Hawaii, you know.
Right, yeah, like the flow is just cooled and,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and
yeah,
frozen in
place. This stuff was apparently not pohoihoi. It was the a'a lava, which leaves sort of a rough and rocky texture, mm-hmm. I think. It's just so craggy, so, mm-hmm. but I just like the words pohoihoi and
pohoihoi. Uh-uh. Mm-hmm. Right. I guess the Hawaiians have imposed their lava terminology on the planet.
That's exactly what they've done, yeah. They know the most about lava, so we're just going to, or at least they've been dealing with the lava, the you know, longer than others, or I don't know, or we just like their words.
Yeah.
Honestly, I like their words.
It's more fun to say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what I say when I put
But pohoihoi is better than snafusyokul.
It's easier for me to say. I'll say that. Yeah, but the pohoihoi off lava is where you have slow eruption, where there's very thin layers uh-huh. of lava. So it's very slow, it's very viscous, uh-huh. and looks, you know, like molten honey sort of an uh-huh. idea, molten rock that looks like honey. And that is not the kind you get when you get a really big eruption, and Iceland has big eruptions.
Right.
You get the a'a lava, which is, it's so tall, it has like, these huge layers of lava. Mm-hmm. It's very thick and very runny. And so you get a completely different landscape than I was expecting.
I've actually seen lava coming down a volcano.
Have you? Which volcano was it?
Arenal in Costa Rica. Mm-hmm. I was there in 1998, which is a time of relatively high activity for Arenal. And so you could go and kind of sit in the hot springs around Arenal, and at night you could watch the orange glow of lava. It was really cool.
That would be really neat.
It was really, really cool. Yeah. That must have been the pohoihoi.
Would have been pohoihoi. If it was a'a lava, you would be going, ah, get out.
This is Pompeii, right?
A'a lava is run for your life lava. Yeah. And pohoihoi is like, let me get my camera.
So what did you see when you went there?
As we're driving through and we find the 10-15 foot, you know, tall piles of rock lava, rough lava, kind of just like strewn about. Like, it is very sort of, it's not just like, oh yeah, there's a lava boulder there. And there's a, no, it's just like fields of it. And you can't drive through it. You kind of have to just drive around it. Mm-hmm. Piles of volcanic rock. It's basically covering the whole landscape. Like, it's making it unusable.
I feel like I've seen SUVs driving across this landscape in commercials. You telling me that
other landscapes. We're not saying the entire landscape of Iceland is covered in lava fields, but there are certain areas that certainly are. You just can't get across it. So there's good reason that one of their famous legends features two berserkers, Hali and Leknir.
Oh yes.
Whose great feat was to build a bridle path through the lava field. Now, Brian, I said bridle path. Is a bridle path for horses or for brides?
Horses, of course. Brides don't wear bridles. Typically.
I mean, the boring ones don't.
I'm not going to ask.
Well, in fact, while this was a bridle path, it was intended to be a bridle, as in, like, for horses. It is also a bridle path, as in, for brides, because that's why they did it. The chieftain, his name was Viga, promised one of the berserkers his daughter if they built this bridle path for him. So, and honestly, yeah. Considering the magnitude of such an undertaking, moving all these lava rocks around, yeah, I'd let them marry my daughter, too.
All right, how did they choose who got the wife? Rock, paper, scissors?
It doesn't really matter, I guess. They never got the chance because neither got the girl because Daddy Chieftain murdered the two berserkers by locking them in a sauna.
Classic Viking behavior.
There's a few other types of lava fields that we encountered during a trip.
Matt, could you... pedantically drone on about all of the different types of lava.
God, I thought you would never ask. This is really making my day. The surfaces they leave behind were interesting, you know, because it depends on how the lava cools as it flows. Imagine a huge wave of lava, mm-hmm. and so the bottom layer of the lava is in contact with the land, so it cools off mm-hmm. and solidifies a little bit. But the top of it is also in contact with the air.
Yeah.
So it's cooling and solidifying.
But
the middle
there.
Part, in the middle, yeah, the middle part of the lava Oreo, it's still molten. Mm-hmm. So it still flows. Mm-hmm. And so what happens then is that you end up with these areas where there's a bottom layer mm-hmm. and there's a top layer And sometimes they're like connected, but a lot of them are hollow on the inside. And so over time, they kind of collapse a little bit and or a lot bit, depending on how it is. So in some of the fields, it's just all just piles of just like fallen down broken rock and stuff like that. And it's all, there's lots of hollows, there's lots of crevices. It looks like troll country is what I think. I always called it when I looked at it. It looks like, you know, any of these could be, you know, trolls hiding in there.
All right. Excellent. Did you guys go see the chimneys in Dimmerburger?
Dimmerburger? Actually, it's a pretty good pronunciation. It really was kind of a Dimmerburgen.
Dimmerburger.
Yeah. This was by a lake near Lake Mewaten. There was these tall little steam chimneys because if that flow went over a body of water, then yes, it's going to boil the water under it, which then has
lava,
to...
Lava, the most effective way of boiling water. I highly recommend it.
I think it's a pretty good idea. Yeah, really.
You have access to a volcano.
If you have access to a volcano or geothermal power. Yeah. And so like the water kind of bursts through the lava, you know, cooling as it does, making these little vents and chimneys. And then the lava keeps on flowing. So all that's left is these little chimney formations. And they look like little castles or big trolls. And it was a very interesting sort of landscape.
Yeah. Sounds like it. Trolls. Oh, the ones turned to stone because they were caught in the sunlight.
That's the way the legend goes. That's where that legend comes from. It's a Norse legend. I think my favorite formations of these lava things are the lava cakes, which form when the top kind of just like gently cracks and then slumps over. It makes this kind of rounded surface with big cracks in it. It looks like a lava cake. There's a reason they call lava cakes, because they look like these lava cakes. I think if they should build a bakery right next to them. They look delicious.
Straight from the volcanic oven. Well, Matt, all of this talk of lava and what was it? Poi poi lava?
Pahoy hoy.
All of this has me thinking that Iceland must be a very dangerous place to live. And if you live there, you probably want some way of knowing when the and pahoy hoy and the pyroclastic flow is coming. So you want to know when it erupts. And that is a problem, right?
I think that is a problem.
It's hard to predict. But all of these flows of magma have their effects, right, that can be detected. It's this little interesting bit of science where they're using fiber optic cables. This is the scientists on the, I think it's the Rakan Peninsula?
Reykjanes.
Reykjanes Peninsula is a sort of primary...
It's right there by Reykjavik, so it's an important place.
Right. So you've got volcanic activity there, but they've set up this system. They've been testing this system where they use existing like telecommunication fiber optic cables. They shoot lasers through those, and then those lasers can detect the vibrations that are generated. And there are these subterranean flows of magma that precede the actual eruption. So you can get a bit of warning that this is about to happen, based upon how those vibrations distort the laser, trigger a phase shift in the laser. So they can use that to detect and get a little bit of extra warning about the impending disaster.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that they call this the Distributed Acoustic Sensing Network, the DAS.
Right.
It is DAS system.
Yeah.
But acoustic makes me think of sound.
Right. So it's like... sound waves, I guess, traveling through the earth, but those vibrations distort the light,
the fiber optic cable, and therefore the light.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. Using light to detect sound.
Yes.
Ooh.
Very interesting.
I think that sounds pretty cool.
Well, we've got fire. We've dealt with fire. This is the land of fire and ice, so we need to deal with the icy portion of it.
We should. That means glacier, yeah. So what makes a glacier a glacier?
Superior engineering, the quality of the flush.
What?
The overflow protection system. We're talking about the toilets, right?
Why are we talking about toilets?
I don't know.
That's Glacier Bay. That's that's a toilet brand.
Oh my
gosh. It's so what truly makes a glacier then, right? Like just a hunk of ice? It's mobility. It can move. Glaciers flow, and that flow is because they are big and they are heavy. So size matters. Actually, here's a fun little segue. Do you know how ice skating works?
I know this. So you strap the knives to your shoes, right? And then you're carried over the ice by thousands of tiny ice fairies.
That is half right. The knife part's right. I will not say that the ice fairies have been proven to be correct.
I prefer to think that the ice fairies are carrying me. We don't really know, though, because they're very, very tiny and hard to detect. Goodness.
Well, what really happens, if you must know, is that, yes, strap knives to your shoes. And the point of those knives is they're very sharp. And so your body mass pushes down on a very small surface area. And that exerts a huge amount of pressure on the ice below your feet. And so it actually crushes the ice into a liquid.
And you slide over that?
And you slide over that. You're sliding technically over water.
Yeah. So this is water skating then?
I mean, yeah, technically. Yeah, I guess no one's ever ice skated before. Because when you're skating, it's water. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like water. They call it a pseudo liquid. And of course, it freezes the instant you take the pressure away. But glaciers are doing much of the same thing. Glaciers are stupidly large. They're very big. They're very heavy. And so the very bottom layers of the glacier are technically a liquid. And they're kind of just flowing very slowly over the surface. It's just the bottom layers, though. The rest of the top, the rest of the glacier is still solid. What's funny is that the ice from glaciers is at the bottom layers. Uh-huh. Surprisingly clear. Surprisingly mm-hmm. clear, because like all the air bubbles have been like crushed out of it, and so it's just like this perfectly clear ice, like the kind you buy at really fancy like cocktail bars.
Yeah, but hold on. So we extract air bubbles from glaciers to learn about the atmosphere, right? Over the last couple of million years or million and a half years, we talked about Beyond Epica. Don't you remember?
That's
Epica
true.
Epica,
yeah.
And Beyond,
yeah,
Epica.
I remember this.
But I guess that's not the bottom, very bottommost layers.
Very bottom. But even then, I think you're still... So it's probably wrong for me to say that the air was being pushed out. Because, like, where would it go? Mm-hmm. No, it's being pushed into the ice. It's dissolving in the ice. Mm-hmm. And so we're just getting really small, tiny air bubbles instead of big, large ones. Mm-hmm. So that's probably a better way to say that. Thank you for the correction.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm.
We can talk about color, too, though, because if you have seen freshly exposed ice from a glacier, you know, it just fell into the ocean, just broke off, fell into the ocean, and it looks like really blue, yeah. Like this really pretty sort of blue. Mm-hmm. You know where that color comes from?
Comes from wavelengths of lights that are reflecting off of the glacier.
And the ones that are absorbing. Oh. Absorption is also important mm-hmm. here. So when light shines upon a surface, right? Some of that light's going to be reflected back.
Right.
So when you have, like, for instance, snow and rough ice, you know, it's on the surface, it always looks very white in color. Well, it's because all the light that you see, all the sunlight is being reflected because it has so many surfaces, right? Mm-hmm. Little tiny crystals, lots of surfaces. So there's lots of places for the light to bounce off of it, and so it looks white.
So you get all the different wavelengths reflected.
You just reflect them right back to you.
Yeah.
Most things reflect equally, mm-hmm. right? Most colors reflect equally off the surfaces there. But for the ice that is all one big crystal, mm-hmm. or for the ocean, when the light penetrates through it, it can be absorbed by the atoms and molecules that it runs into. And for ice and water, they absorb more of the reds and the greens than they do blues and such. So that's why the blue light persists, and therefore ice looks nice and blue. And the water looks blue as well.
Excellent. And I guess you became intimately familiar with glaciers while you were there. You hiked around on them.
Yeah, we got to hike on top of a glacier. It was really cool.
I saw pictures of you with ropes and helmets and things.
Mm-hmm. But it was really nice up there. We hiked upon the glacier to see it from the top, but we also took a little boat trip to drive around this little lagoon where, you know, the icebergs were falling off the glaciers.
Mm-hmm.
And then you
calving.
Could see them. Calving, is that the word?
Yeah. That's when the glacier creates big chunks of ice. Gives birth to.
As I say, is this calving like,
yeah,
like cows?
Yeah, it's the same word. It's but it gives they give birth to these.
The big one
of
makes
ice.
Small ones. It's
yes.
calving.
Yep.
That's cute. That's cute. It. Yeah. And then all the little ice chunks would float up on, would wash ashore, and you can mm-hmm. go look at them. And people were licking them. I think that was a bad idea. I would never lick an iceberg.
It's probably ancient viruses from
right
Snorri,
like you don't even know Snorri's what was day. In there. Yeah, it's like, geez, that's a terrible idea.
Don't lick the ice.
Don't
folks.
Lick ice.
Don't lick the ice.
Everyone knows you don't lick
don't
the
lick,
ice.
Don't lick the blue ice.
That's right.
Well, what other bits of Iceland science do you have for us? Lots of geothermal energy there. That's, I guess, part of the volcano.
Yes.
The volcanic activity, right? You've got so much magma and stuff close to the surface, so much heat to the, close to the surface that they can, you know, generate all their power from.
At least most of their power, or some of their power. Yeah, they can generate from just geothermal sources. Iceland has parts of it are spewing lava into the surface. Some parts are spewing hot water and steam and sulfur. Apparently, Iceland is the land of just like the earth upchucking things onto the surface. It's just Earth's vomitory.
No, there you go.
But
you should work for the Icelandic Tourism Bureau.
That's what they
right?
want to hear. Put it on your flyers.
The land of fire and vomit.
That's great. But you know, to their credit, in 2025. The total electricity consumption of Iceland was provided almost entirely from renewable sources. That's about 70.5% of it from hydropower, so from like, you know, hydroelectric dams, mm-hmm. stuff like that. 29.4% from geothermal power, and only 0.1% actually came from fossil fuels. And that's usually from like really remote places that just can't get connected to the network.
That's probably helicopters going back and forth.
Right. Yeah. I mean, some of the islands are just so remote. Like you just got to use a diesel generators to get any power. But it honestly, when I saw that 29.4% from geothermal power, I expected it to be a lot higher. Mm-hmm. But then I realized that that's not the only use for geothermal power. You don't have to turn it into electricity. When they say they get so much power from geothermal wells, they don't necessarily mean that they're turning into electricity. You can also just use it to straight up heat yourself.
Yeah, use the steam to.
And that's the most efficient way to use geothermal power is geothermal heat. So like 90% of homes are heated directly with geothermal energy. Hot water from the geothermal vents runs through their home radiators, runs under streets to keep the snow melted, mm-hmm. Heating their, you know, potable water, and even their swimming pools. You know, there's lots of public pools, and it's all just heated for free, practically, mm-hmm. or, you know, for pennies or for kroner, I guess.
Yes. If you want cold water, you have to jump in the ocean.
So using geothermal heat to heat is the most efficient thing to do with it, after all. Rather than just turning into electricity.
Hmm. So how do they get the hot water to the cities?
So the area is heavy in geothermal activity, you know. So this is back to the tectonic plates, you know, the divide between the tectonic plates. They've dug all these boreholes down into the earth to collect the hot water and the steam. And it's really cute when you see where the boreholes are. They're all marked by these little red, like brick red geodesic huts. That go over and they have this big pipe running off. So it's like these cute little geodesic huts. But that's a borehole. And so they're all over certain areas where they have high geothermal activity.
Yeah.
And then they just pipe it either right back to Reykjavik, as were lots of the pipes we saw, or they go to the power plant. So big pipes running all over the place.
So Matt, I gather you now fancy yourself something of an Icelandic science expert.
Absolutely.
So allow me to test you. Do you know what scientists at the Natural Science Institute of Iceland found for the first time in 2025?
Ooh, the ability to talk to strangers.
No, not yet.
Okay, was it the ghost of Snorri Sturluson?
No, and it wasn't the ghost of Ronald Reagan.
Why would you bring him up again?
It was mosquito fluga. That's right. Mosquito fluga. Grinda Islandi is frustasin. Can you guess what a mosquito fluga is? It's pretty easy.
Honestly, I think enough German. I had that. Fluga is like to fly, wings, right. Stuff like that. So mosquito fluga, is this mosquito wings?
That's just mosquitoes, right?
Oh, okay. So. I guess mosquito flies is what they're saying.
Right.
Mosquito flies. Not just a house fly, but a mosquito fly.
So for a long time, Iceland was famous, and I think they did include this in their brochures. It was very famously mosquito-free, so arthropod-poor and mosquito-free. But last year, for the first time, they caught three mosquitoes. Trapped to a, there was a trap that was set up to pick up moths, but they... to their surprise, found attached to that trap, they found three mosquitoes. So this was just last year in 2025 that they found this. So mosquitoes join a growing list here. We don't know how kind of extensive the mosquito infestation is. I don't think they've caught a lot of them in the subsequent months, but you know, who knows?
It was me. I brought them in my carry-on. I did. I guess, yeah, I don't remember seeing any mosquitoes over there. The midges, we did get midges. They were not the biting midges, thankfully. Right. We did encounter biting midges in Scotland, and those were awful.
Yeah. So the mosquitoes join a growing list of arthropods that are showing up in Iceland that were not there before. So just in the last couple of years, bark beetles have established themselves there in Iceland, and that's a pest for forests. And there aren't that many forests in Iceland.
No, there are not. They chopped them all down to make boats.
Yeah, I think I saw a figure that was something like 2% of the land is covered by forests. And I think a lot of that is like reforestation efforts where they're trying to.
I think so. I think they went down to zero forests for a while.
Right. So I think the arrival of bark beetles that may set reforestation goals back is probably not a welcome development. And of course, about 10 years ago, the blood-sucking, biting midges that you just referenced there, they will make your life miserable. So those have been there since 2015, I think. The non-biting midges have been there for a long time, much longer. So there's many more species and an established population of the non-biting chironomid midges. But that's, of course...
Chironomid? Like Tyrannosaurus? Like no. Tyrannomid?
No, chironomid.
I misheard.
Chiron.
Very well. All right. I was hearing like Tyrannid, like the Tyrannus.
No, it's Chironomidae. Anyway, so this is what's happening as the Arctic warms four times as fast as other latitudes. You're seeing dramatic changes in the distribution of lots and lots of species, including ones that we don't necessarily want to show up. So the changes are equally dramatic in marine ecosystems. We've had these MHVs, marine heat waves, with increasing frequency, and there was a particularly strong one in 2003. And some recently published research trying to put together a picture of how these marine ecosystems changed. What we're dealing with here is more heat coming into the North Atlantic. So you've got very sort of complex interaction between different currents. You've got that North Atlantic current. You've got a branch of it that goes off kind of by Iceland and Greenland. You've got this kind of gyre, this circulation cell that's right around there too, kind of in between Greenland and Iceland. The East Greenland current that's coming down that's carrying cold water. And it's kind of the interaction of all of those that sets up all these different environments.
Sounds very complex. And like there's many like positive reinforcement loops, which are always kind of dastardly when it comes to climate science.
So there are all sorts of very, very complex effects and lots of things that are dependent, very sensitive to, you know, contextual factors. Essentially, what's happening is that you are getting, you know, dramatic changes in the temperature of the water, which is then affecting all different parts of the food chain, right? It's affecting your phytoplankton, which is the photosynthetic stuff, right? And then you have the zooplankton, things like copepods and so on that are feeding on other stuff there. And those are the food sources for other things, for bigger fish and, you know, for whales and things. And so you get sort of dramatic shifts. So they detailed some in this study. One of the effects was, for instance, fewer narwhals around Iceland. You didn't see a narwhal, did you, Matt?
I did not. Yeah. I did not see a narwhal.
You were robbed from seeing the narwhal by the shifts that were caused here because the narwhals went farther north.
You know, I had students once who made fun of me because I said narwhal instead of narwhal.
Yeah.
And I thought it was pronounced narwhal. And I was like, it's not a type of whale. It's a narwhal. Right? It's not a whale. It's a narwhal. And they were like, it's narwhal. And I was like...
I'm pretty sure it's narwhal.
It is narwhal, and you're right. But like, geez, they were rather mean to me. I had to go to my quiet place and cry for a little bit.
You know, science is a minefield. I mean, there's so many terms that are thrown at you, and you can't know how to pronounce all of them up front. You know,
but apparently, narwhal is one of them. You got to have.
All right. Well, that's all I've got. I felt compelled to introduce biology into the picture here.
And I'm glad that you did. Yes. I didn't want to talk the whole time.
Yeah. Yes, you did.
That's a lie. but that's all I have to say about Iceland for the moment. So
that is the end of this edition of Uncle Traveling Matt's Icelandic Diaries.
natural thing in it. It's totally natural thing in it. It's totally natural thing in it. It's
next up, we have Matt's Chemical Minute, a segment lasting 5 to 7 indeterminate units of time. Matt is going to tell us about an element, compound, or other chemical entity that we should care about. He will then give this entity a rating of 1 to 5 stars. I will listen and then argue with Matt about his rating. Today, Matt takes up Icelandium, atomic number 23. That's the right name, isn't it?
Vanadium is the actual element we're talking about today, but vanadium takes its name from Vanadis. Mm-hmm. It's named after Freya, the Norse goddess of fertility, beauty, wisdom, clairvoyance, apparently like practically everything. Mm-hmm.
Is she the one that Friday is named after? Is that Freya's day?
I think so it is, yeah, Freya's right. day. Because Thursday is Thor's day.
Yeah, Wednesday is Odin's day. Mm-hmm. But there are a couple that have very similar names. You know, there are a couple of the female goddesses that have very similar names that I sometimes confuse. But I think it's Freya that's Friday.
But anyways, vanadium is our element of the day, and it is atomic number 23. It's monoisotopic, so that means it only has really one isotope that exists. About 99.8% is vanadium 51.
I was going to say 51, right?
51 is the number, yeah. Just a little bit of vanadium 50, but that's all there is.
So it's not really monoisotopic.
No.
It's diisotopic.
It's technically, there's technically a smidge of this other one, but whatever. I guess the only stable, it has only one stable isotope. The unstable isotope is still produced primordially. You know, it's still produced naturally, but that doesn't mean that it's a stable isotope. So I think when they say monoisotopic, we don't necessarily mean that there's only one isotope. We say there's only one stable isotope. Mm. But generally, that's the only isotope out there, but not the case here. Native vanadium is pretty rare. So like scandium, it's only produced as a byproduct of other ores, in particular, uranium. So if you're mining for uranium, you're probably going to find your vanadium as well.
So it's mixed in together. You're not saying uranium
produced. No. Yeah. We're saying uranium ore also has vanadium in it. Yeah. 85% of vanadium produced ends up as ferrovanadium, also called vanadium steel.
Ooh.
I know. Sounds like Valyrian steel.
Yeah,
Game
does.
Of Thrones, but it's not. It is still one of those wonderful alloy elements that we love. Many transition elements, just throw them into an alloy and you get something magical. In this case, most of ferrovanadium, vanadium steel, is actually vanadium. The most common is FeV80, so there's iron, and then there's vanadium. And FeV80 sounds like a terrible chemical formula, because it's not like there's 80 vanadiums.
It's 80% of the...
It's 80%, is what they're saying. Yeah, they're saying it's 80% by mass vanadium. Ferrovanadium alloys are highly resistant to corrosion, so they find use as like industrial pipes, but they also have a very high tensile strength, so they get made into like wrenches, spanners, and such like that. So, of course, hearing this, I went out to my garage to be like, do I have vanadium steel tools? Do I have any? Can I go kill White Walkers with them, you know? And I couldn't find anything in my garage that was marked as vanadium. The best I found were tools that are marked CRV steel, which is a chromium vanadium steel alloy. But that's like 1% chromium and only 0.18% vanadium. So that's an iron. That's a steel alloy. Mm-hmm. That's a steel mostly. It's not, I don't know, whatever.
Steel has to have carbon in it, right?
Yes, it does. Yeah. But still. But steel. Still. Stupid. The remaining 15% of vanadium produced finds its way into like one of two categories. It's either made into catalysts. For instance, the catalyst is V2O5. That's vanadium 5 oxide, which is used in production of like sulfuric acid. So I like it. Making sulfuric acid is very neat.
You're a big sulfuric acid fan.
Also, the name vanadium 5 oxide. We use the Roman numerals to say vanadium 5. So it's vanadium V. Vanadium V oxide. That just looks cool. Mm. It really does look cool. Vanadium's like the coolest looking word. Mm. But the other thing they use is a special type of battery, which I had never come across before. So this is very exciting to me to come across a very cool new type of battery. It's not like new, but it's new to me. Mm-hmm. So it's called the redox flow battery. And it's a battery that's almost entirely in solution. It's like liquid. It's all dissolved in electrolyte. So most batteries have a solid anode, a solid cathode, and then the liquid electrolyte, or maybe a polymer electrolyte. But either way, it's mostly in the solid phase, except the electrolyte, which might be, you know, liquid. It might be in the liquid phase. But in the flow battery, the reactions between the anode and cathode, all of these reactions, are in solution as dissolved ions in the electrolyte. So you have two separate electrolytes, the anolyte, not analyte like you're analyzing it, but anolyte like the anode electrolyte, anolyte, and the catholyte, which is the cathode electrolyte.
So you've got a positive electrolyte and you've got a negative electrolyte.
Exactly, you do. So they're still doing the same things that anodes and cathodes do, right? Mm-hmm. Anodes undergo oxidation, producing electrons. Cathodes undergo reduction, pulling in electrons. And so they're still doing those reactions, one side producing electrons, one side taking in electrons. And that causes the flow of electrons, but they're doing it as liquids. They're doing it all in the liquid phase. Mm. That means that you have a different idea of what the capacity of a redox flow battery is. In a normal solid battery, you're limited by the size of the anode and the cathode, right? You have to have, it has to be all encased in metal usually, but you have a solid amount, and it seems very dense. At least you have a high density there, but you're limited in the amount of mass you can put into this thing. In a redox flow battery, if space is not a consideration, then you can just have buckets, barrels of the anolyte and catholyte, and then you just pump them past the very small little redox cell. So instead of having like, oh, I have to have an amount of anode and cathode encased within this thing, no, you can just like pump it in. And so the anolyte and the catholyte pump in like the bottom of this little sandwich looking device. And as they flow past each other on either side of this ion exchange membrane, they do their redox magic, and then they are pumped out the top into the used electrolyte canister. And so if you want more capacity, you just make electrolyte, just make it bigger. Just give it more. And so it's like these little cells that can just run for a long time.
And that's useful because usually we're not thinking about size at all when we think about batteries, right? Well, we're not concerned at all about how we're not concerned about how dense it is or compact or anything like that. We think, well, gee, I've got warehouses full of space to hold barrels of electrolytes.
One would say this is not for a phone or a car. One would say this is for grid storage for a city, because you can recharge this battery the same way. Turn the pump around, and then the used electrolyte becomes refreshed again.
So like this is being used when we store...
We're storing energy.
Electricity that's coming from wind turbines or photovoltaic cells, then you're storing it in a facility.
Correct.
And you're using this technology to do that.
Yeah, so this is part of energy storage thing for like large grid storage. It is not as efficient, we will say. It is not as efficient as normal lithium ion batteries. Those are still going to be the best you ever find. But as far as like huge capacity, there's a lot more vanadium out there than there is lithium. So we can make more of this stuff too. So yeah, as far as like large scale grid storage, we can use this. So I bring this up now because vanadium is used in these redox flow batteries on both sides. In one side, in the anolyte, we have vanadium 2 going to vanadium 3. And then on the other side, we have vanadium 5 going to vanadium 4 in the catholyte. So vanadium gets used in both sides because vanadium can go through many oxidation states. And so it's a very, very cool thing. I just think that's really interesting. I've never come across a redox flow battery before, but now I want to see one. I want to build one.
I'm surprised you're using something. I mean, like the big advantage of lithium is it's very small, right? So you get lots of electrons.
Yeah.
Very small size, but this is pretty big.
This is going the entire other way. This is not going the let's be efficient about space. It's just being like, let's do this in a way that
I guess it all ties together.
Yeah. It's just a different type of problem they're trying to address.
All right. Well, I think we need a rating.
I love that vanadium, I mean, above all things, I just love that vanadium taught me about a new type of battery. So for that alone, it's getting 4 stars. I love it.
4 stars. You know, nothing you really said there excited me too much, honestly.
Tough crowd, this guy.
Maybe if it were really called Icelandium, then I would give it...
Snorri Sturlasonium.
I'm going to go with... I mean, there's no real downside to it. Nobody's being murdered by vanadium or anything like that.
Unless someone used their vanadium spanner to, like, bump you on the head.
That's true, right? It's exceptionally strong, so, you know. I'll give it 2 stars.
I think Freya will be cursing you for this.
That's okay.
That's what I think.
All right.
All right. Well, anyways, that's an average of 3 stars from the Yakety Science crew.
Excellent. All right. Thanks, Matt. I guess next time we've got number 24. That's the shiniest of all elements, I believe. Chromium.
Yeah, it is chromium.
Yeah. Aren't you proud of me?
I'm very proud of you. You didn't have to look it up or anything.
Yeah. We didn't have to cut this all together to make me seem smart, right?
That's right.
Ironikos prosphilos eleluth.
All right, before we go, we need to take care of this episode's sound science puzzler. Here it is again, in case you've forgotten. So that's it. That's your sound science puzzler. Matt, you know what it is because you brought this sound in.
I know what it is, yeah. We heard this sound, and we honestly, the first time we heard it, Alice and I were thought like, what's this weird like kind of mechanical sound?
Sounds like a drone or something.
We thought it was a drone, yeah. We thought we were looking around like, what punk is flying a drone around here? Like, oh, it's so annoying. I think they're so rude to have drones. But no, it was not. It was this bird flying over. And it was a snipe, a common snipe in Iceland. And they do this thing, it's called drumming, snipe drumming. It's not a vocalization. It's actually a sound they're making with their tail feathers. Mm-hmm. Their tail feathers are kind of ridged in a weird way. As the air passes over them, it makes this kind of vibration sort of sound.
Right.
And it sounds like that. So it's a display. That's what it is. It's trying to attract a mate, maybe.
Some of our listeners may be surprised to learn that the snipe is an actual thing because they've heard about
snipe hunting
being sent on snipe hunts, and it's a kind of a practical joke that people play on each other. But there are actual snipes. The snipe is a real thing.
They're a little probing bird.
It's a kind of shorebird. It's a kind of a plover sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Big feet,
right?
Cute long nose.
The eyes are kind of almost on the side of the head. Very long.
Yeah.
Beak, right? It's kind of
and the eyes
absurdly
are like
straight.
Far back on the skull.
Right, that's what
it's
I was saying.
Really
it's kind
weird.
Of on the side so that they can see kind of all around themselves easily. They've got very wide peripheral vision. But anyway, we have Wilson snipe around here. This is the common snipe that's breeding there in Iceland. So, interesting birds. As always, we leave you with a wise, wise quote from an Icelandic person of note. Guess it's not always an Icelandic person, but this time it is because it is. Can you guess?
Is it Snorri Sturluson?
It's Snorri Sturluson, of course. Who else?
Snorri, son of Sturl.
That's right. And he said, "Who has ever wandered through such forest in a length of many miles, in a boundless expanse, without a path, without a goal, amid their monstrous shadows, their sacred gloom, without being filled with deep reverence for the sublime greatness of nature, above all human agency?" Much cheerier than most of Snorri Sturluson's quotes.
I was going to say, yeah, I liked this one quite a bit, though.
"Nothing about men will know misery." Anyway, with those words, we leave you, dear listeners, until the next episode of Yakety Science. Thanks for joining us.
Take care now. Bye.
Yakety Science is produced, written, and edited by Matt Smith and Brian Cross. Production help provided by Scott Gregory. Theme music by Lobo Loco. Yakety Science is recorded at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa and at the Center for Creativity at Tulsa Community College. If you'd like to yak back at us, our email is yaketyscience@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Home, home on the range, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging bird, and the skies, they are not cloudy all day.
Such a dork.
As the deer and the antelope say are playing. Yeah.